From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a West Michigan school district works to get more students of color into AP classes and high-performing schools.
This is not just a challenge for Grand Rapids Public Schools. Districts across this state and across this nation are facing similar challenges.
GM's Mary Barra meets with the president.
You know, what's the Trump effect going to be? What's the Justice Department effect going to be? There's a lot of things going on all at the same time, and I suspect that that's one of the things that Mary Barra knows she's got to manage.
And a refresher course for Michigan drivers, what to do when an emergency vehicle comes up in your rearview mirror.
So the law is pretty clear on that. It talks about a little bit about moving over, and then here's the part that nobody ever does, and that's stop.
Those stories and more for you today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. After 4 years of voluntary federal oversight to improve Black student access to more programs, the Grand Rapids Public Schools District says it is not stopping efforts to combat inequity.
There's still that question of whether or not these are welcoming environments for students of color, and we're going to continue to work on tearing down that barrier and changing that perception.
Later in the program, the long road to desegregation in our public schools. But first, from 2013 to 2015, the state's unemployment insurance agency, the UIA, wrongly accused thousands of Michiganders of making fraudulent claims. People lost their homes, their jobs. More than 1,000 filed for bankruptcy. In February of 2017, I spoke with David Vella. For the 11 months that he was out of work, he got unemployment. When David went back to work, he stopped claiming benefits. But 4 years later, he discovered the UIA had decided that he had cheated the system out of $6,500.
Oh, my goodness. My jaw dropped. I mean, what? For what? I didn't do anything wrong. I couldn't understand it. I've never been so upset and felt so wronged against by the government, and they just didn't care. No matter what I did, no matter what person I went to, there was no help anywhere I could go, and it felt like I was in the middle of a lake with no oar, no help, nobody.
Well, eventually, administrative law judge ruled the state had wrongfully garnished over $4,800 from David's wages, and a few weeks later, he got that money back. But more than 6 years since this all began, many people have not been made whole, and here to talk about that is GongWare's Zach Gorchow. Zach, first, a brief refresher. How did so many Michiganders come to be wrongly accused of fraud by the state?
The state implemented an automated system to not only look for possible fraud, but to form definitive final conclusions on whether fraud had occurred. And so this computer system was programmed in a way that caused the way people who were using the unemployment system were reporting their income to conclude that they did not deserve unemployment benefits and thus had committed fraud to get them, when in fact nothing could have been further from the truth. And some 37,000 people were wrongly found by the state and its computer system to have committed fraud between 2013 and 2015.
So even though, you know, it was somewhat overshadowed by the big debacle in Flint, but this was big, as you say, 37,000 lives. Do we have any idea how many people are still waiting to be made whole?
Well, it depends on how you define made whole. The state insists that everybody, or nearly everybody, that they can find has been repaid the benefits, interest, and penalties they were forced to pay back. They insist that, I believe it's more than $20 million has been repaid to those folks. Now, if you talk to the attorneys for some of the key people in these cases, they will question that. And that does not take into account damages. You know, there were 1,100 people who were wrongly found to have committed fraud who filed for bankruptcy. Think about the legal costs and the damages to one's credit that were inflicted upon those folks. Did people lose houses? Were they late on mortgage payments and forced to pay fines? You know, just the stress. You know, how do you define made whole? Perhaps you were paid back for all you were forced to wrongly pay to the state, but Would you feel made whole if you went through that kind of an ordeal and you simply got back what was wrongly taken from you?
So this week, House Democrats rolled out a package of bills aiming to fully reimburse Michiganders who were wrongly accused of this unemployment fraud and increase unemployment benefits. Why are they doing this now?
Well, I think some of it is that there are two lawsuits against the Michigan Unemployment Insurance Agency over these false fraud charges that are dragging. One has been going for about 4 years. Another has been going for more than 2 years. And there's really no end in sight. There's just no sign at this point that there's going to be a meaningful outcome, whether that's via settlement or a judgment, that resolves the plaintiff's concerns and claims. So I think that this is a second stab at a victim's compensation fund that the state would create for those who are wronged by the unemployment agency. There was an attempt to create one of these in the last legislative term, but it never really got off the ground. There was a Republican member of the House who was championing this, but the Senate Republicans just didn't want to do it. They felt like because at the time the state lawsuit filed in state court over this had been dismissed. The Court of Appeals had dismissed the case, and for whatever reason they weren't taking the federal case seriously, and they felt, well, why would we, the state, outlay a bunch of money when we're not even technically still under lawsuit? However, since that happened, the Michigan Supreme Court overturned the Court of Appeals and reinstated that state case.
So how much would be needed to make people whole, and is the money there in the budget to do it?
Well, again, it depends on how you define that. The House Republican who was looking at this last year was looking at a number like $30 million. Well, that's relatively small potatoes. I don't have a calculator right in front of me, but I believe it's less than $10,000 per person. You know, for those who had to file bankruptcy, that's probably not commensurate with the damage that was inflicted. The plaintiffs at one point were looking for hundreds of millions of dollars, but the case they filed, that claim that they had filed hasn't seemed to have been going anywhere. So we're probably talking something substantial, though. It's hard for me to envision the state gets out of this for less than $100 million, just given the number of plaintiffs involved. It seems apparent. I mean, obviously, a court hasn't found that the state committed wrong, but when you look at the Auditor General report that came out that was extremely critical of the state, I mean, nobody disputes the state screwed up severely here. It's just a question of how much, and is there any chance the state could get these cases kicked on a technicality? So far, they've been unsuccessful.
And briefly, just the last few seconds, if it's so clear harm was done and the state screwed up so badly, why hasn't the state settled yet?
Because the amount of money at stake is so potentially substantial. I mean, the state can't just willy-nilly write a check for potentially $400 million, which if you were to just sort of do some basic calculations, you can get to that number pretty quickly. The state does have a fiduciary obligation to defend its position for the taxpayers. And at least right now, the new governor and the new attorney general, the focus seems to be more on getting the Flint cases resolved. There's no sign that they've made any settlement overture in these cases. In fact, they seem to still be defending the state just as vigorously as Governor Snyder and Attorney General Schuette were.
Zach Gorchow from Gongwer News Service with the update. Zach, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Cindy.
Sturgeon are a long, gray, spiny, prehistoric fish, and they can live up to 100 years old. But overfishing and habitat destruction has decimated their population across the state. Some baby sturgeon were recently released as part of a joint effort between the state, tribes, and also conservation groups, all to restore populations of this ancient fish. Michigan Radio's Kay LaFond attended a release ceremony that was hosted by the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians.
About 80 people stand in a circle surrounding Fred Harrington. He sits on the ground. Just behind him is a large trailer, and in it are 56 baby lake sturgeon.
But our sturgeon is one of our are thought-provoking clans, one of our clans of wisdom, and we learn from the sturgeon.
Harrington is on the tribal council of the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians. He's giving a teaching about sturgeon, talking about their significance in Odawa culture.
So when we we think about the past, we look to the one who's been here the longest, and the sturgeon has been here for a long time. You know, they say
the sturgeon and the trailer were born in the nearby Black River. They were scooped up and spent a few months getting strong at the tribe's fish hatchery. Now, they're ready to be released into the Sturgeon River from the tiny village of Wolverine. The Sturgeon River flows into Burt Lake, where, like many other places in the state, sturgeon have suffered a massive decline since the 1800s. Habitat destruction and overfishing have left populations at a fraction of what they were.
You know, there used to be probably thousands of fish, adult fish, in Burt Lake. Now we have probably less than 200.
That's Chris Day, hatchery manager for the tribe. He says the fish released today should mature and come back to the river in about 20 years.
So we're looking to manage the population in Burt Lake, and we're hoping that they'll return here to spawn and then flush out back into Burt Lake.
The tribe has released about 3,000 baby sturgeons since 2013. This year, their goal is 700. Because of some cooler weather, most of the fish aren't quite ready. But today is the scheduled sturgeon release celebration. Folding tables are sagging under potluck dishes. Councilmember Harrington came to teach and hold a ceremony. And everywhere, there are kids eager to handle fish. So a few dozen of the tiny creatures have been brought to the river a little early. Day jumps into the back of the trailer and gives a lesson in how biologists track the fish they release.
If you see a white spot on your fish, it's super glue. They have that microchip in them, and we actually have to insert the tag. And to keep the tag from falling out and to have it heal faster, we actually super glue it shut.
He and other staff start handing kids buckets and directing them towards the river. Kevin Donner, fisheries biologist for the tribe, talks his son, Key Waden, through releasing his sturgeon.
Nice and gentle, remember? You got him?
Yeah. Okay, can I throw him in?
Yeah. Say bye.
Bye, fishy.
The fish are apparently hardy enough to survive being handled by kids. Not surprising when you consider that they can live to be over 100. I'm Kay LaFond.
Bye, fishy, the line of the day. Coming up, sick of the slow pokes in the left lane? Do you know what a zipper merge is? Well, after the break, we'll launch a new series on Michigan's forgotten or ignored rules of the road. That's next on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
This superb One Direction highway is engineered for easy grades and for speed with safety. The echoes of that two-cylinder motor have never died, and they never will.
Call the turn signal! Use it!
Traffic deaths in Michigan are up 2% this year, so we felt it would be worthwhile to have a refresher course and review some of Michigan's forgotten or poorly understood traffic rules. For that, we welcome Lieutenant Michael Shaw of the Michigan State Police. So we're going to focus, Michael Shaw, on what to do when an emergency vehicle comes up behind you. And I know you've been that vehicle coming up behind. My father was a firefighter, and I used to hear grumbling about this. So here we are, driving along. Emergency lights are coming up in the rearview mirror. What does the law say we should immediately do as a driver?
So the law is pretty clear on that. It talks about a little bit about moving over, which is the first thing that you're going to do. And then here's the part that nobody ever does, and that's stop. You have to move over to the right and then stop your vehicle. And then what that does, if somebody doesn't hear the siren, somebody's got too much music or too much bass bumping in their car, they're just not paying attention, it gives that emergency vehicle driver an opportunity to kind of cut around to get to where they need to go. Because we're always cautious. That's our biggest fear as we're driving that vehicle, that lights and siren. It does not give us, you know, the immediate authority to, you know, take the right away or get to a crash or not drive safely. That's our job too. But we want people just to know that. And we see it a lot on traffic stops, especially on the freeway system. If you think about it, people say, well, I don't have to stop on the freeway. Well, the law does not give any recourse about that. So yes, you're supposed to do the same thing on the freeway. Usually what happens, though, is by the time people hear the siren and the lights, we're kind of already past you before you kind of make that opportunity. But if traffic is slow enough and you're caught in it, you're supposed to move over to the right. And what that does is gives us the opportunity to always know I'm going to try to stay on the left as much as I can because I know that you're supposed to go to the right. But on a traffic stop too, even on the freeway, you're required to slow down and slowly move over to the right. Sometimes people forget, they see the lights and they panic. And the first thing they want to do is one, I've had people just jam on the brakes in front of me, which is always exciting.
I bet that's exciting for everybody.
Yep.
You and them.
Yep. And also I've had people just dart off to the left shoulder, which is makes it dangerous for both of us because, you know, I got to kind of maneuver my car. So traffic kind of goes around. They don't expect us on the left. So if you just remember, move to the right and stop, you'll be fine.
And this is whether you're on a freeway or you're on a highway with stoplights.
Absolutely.
Get over and stop. Michigan State Police Lieutenant Mike Shaw, thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me.
Which rules of the road do you wish other drivers would know about? Just let us know. Send us an email, stateside@michiganradio.org. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Inequity still exists in schools across Michigan and the nation. We've seen it again and again in so many reports and studies. Generally, minority and low-income students just aren't getting the same level of education as their white, higher-income peers. In the years since the landmark school desegregation case, Brown versus Board of Education, the federal government has implemented several protections which aim to close that gap. But how well do those protections and methods for their enforcement really work? To answer that question, Stateside took a close look at what happened when an underrepresentation of African Americans in advanced classes at Grand Rapids Public Schools was called out through an investigation by the Federal Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights. Our story begins when the district signed on to a resolution agreement with the OCR. That was in 2014. The agreement was essentially an admission from Grand Rapids Public Schools that, yes, there was an inequality problem within the district that needed to be solved. Here's John Hemhold, the district's Executive Director of Communications and External Affairs, to explain.
We voluntarily agreed to resolve this. There was concerns, there was disproportionality. We just simply were not providing those college career readiness, the advanced placement, those honors courses, dual enrollment to enough of our kids, and not just African-American students. It was actually pretty far across the board.
The OCR released the district from the agreement last year after GRPS fulfilled a set of requirements. Here's Hemhold explaining what the district had to do.
A review and a self-assessment to look at the course offerings that were at elementary, middle, high school and identify potential barriers, such as the lack of course offerings, which is really what the basis of this issue was, is that we just simply were not providing those opportunities at our high schools. And then we were looking to increase that participation. We also said we'd survey students. We also retained a consultant that had expertise in advising us on how to address the underrepresentation of African American students in college and career programs.
And Hemhold pointed out the ways in which the Grand Rapids District has improved.
We've had a 290% increase in the number of students that are taking dual enrollment. And breaking that down further, that includes 136% increase for African-American students and a whopping 719% increase for our Hispanic Latino students.
And he went on.
We have more than 283 students are taking AP courses now, and that's 46% Hispanic students, 36% African-American, 11% white, and others. And so we've just seen a significant increase in providing those opportunities at every one of our high schools.
But Stateside looked at the data from last year and found the district still has a way to go in some areas. The most obvious example, the district's highly successful, well-regarded crown jewel, City Middle High School. In that 2014 agreement, OCR said City Middle High's African-American population was, and I'm quoting him, disproportionately low at just 13%. We looked at the Michigan School Data website for last school year and found the African-American population at City really hasn't changed a lot. Why is the Black population at the district top-performing secondary school still so low?
You know, that's a good question, and I there's no easy answer for that. What I can tell you is that what we've been doing to promote admission to our test in schools, and so City High Middle School, and then you also have Zoo School, Blandford School, and the Center for Economic Ecology. They all have that same test in criteria. What we now do, there's a theme school process. We run the data based on the number of students who are already qualified, meaning that they already meet that 50% threshold, and we direct mail them. We chase it with phone calls. We invite them to school choice expos. We have representatives from the schools that go out to the individual elementary and K-8 schools to recruit students. That was also part of our response to the Office of Civil Rights. So as a district, we're being very intentional and being pretty aggressive in seeking to increase the number of students that are attending these tests in schools that are African American Latinx students. And we're also conducting surveys to try to find out, you know, what makes them attractive and why some students choose not to go there. In a lot of cases, the responses have come back that they would want to stay with their peers. They want to go to that base high school where they have comprehensive athletics, where their friends are going to. They, in some cases, are interested in environmental education. And there's an old perception here as well that, you know, 40 years ago when these programs were created, that was a very different time, and segregation desegregation was still fresh off the presses. And so there's still that question of whether or not these are welcoming environments for students of color. And we're going to continue to work on tearing down that barrier and changing that perception. But it's persistent, but it's not for lack of effort on the district's part, and an acknowledgement that we're going to continue to aggressively recruit and target those students, and make, especially when we already know they're pre-qualified. It's like they get a letter that says, congratulations, you are pre-qualified to attend the top school in the region. And so we're putting a lot of effort into it, but we clearly have more work to do.
And OCR took issue with the number of Black students taking AP classes. Recap for us, have there been improvements in the number of students of color in Grand Rapids who are taking AP?
Yeah, I mean, right, we have 83% of the 283 students who are enrolled in the 14 different advanced placement courses across the high schools are students of color. So we've seen an increase in the number of students. We've seen an increase in the number of AP courses offered. And but again, we're going to continue to promote these. We are creating that college-going culture. That's why we've seen these significant increase in our graduation rates, a significant reduction in our dropout rates, and the third highest composite score gains in college career readiness tests. So we've made some significant gains, but again, we're always going to stay on the grind, and we know we can always do better.
Because I've got to wonder a little why the percentage of students taking AP exams varies widely. For example, Ottawa Hills High School has the largest Black population of the district's similar secondary schools, had less than a quarter of its students taking at least one AP exam, and none of them passed any in 2016-2017. What does that say to you as the district?
Well, we know that we've had certainly Ottawa Hills is a school that our previous superintendent and now our current interim superintendent have really staked a flag and said we have got to restore the O. Ottawa Hills has been that historically African American high school. It has great pride in the community. There's a lot of alumni that are rallying around it. We opened our first early middle college program, which is where students start their freshman year, and then they graduate 5 years later with both a high school diploma and with a college or their associate degree at Grand Rapids Community College. We also launched our HBCU initiative, the Historically Black Colleges and Universities. We just launched the Academy of Hospitality and Tourism that's opening this fall. So there is a significant renewed investment in Ottawa Hills because we know we've got to improve the achievement. We have a rock star new principal there this year, and I think there's really high hopes within the district and within this community that we're going to see Ottawa Hills pride restored and that those achievement numbers go up.
John, looking at the five largest secondary schools for Grand Rapids Public Schools, four of them are mainly Hispanic and or Black. And those four schools have a white population either at about 12% or 5%. City Middle High is the only one of those schools mostly white and by a pretty wide margin. You have kind of addressed why you feel there are so many white students at City. Do you want to drill down on that a little bit more, the district's highest performing secondary school?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's really important to acknowledge that Grand Rapids is still a rather segregated city, and it's not uncommon for many of our urban areas. And so there were some historical trends that date back years before this transformation plan went into effect, and some of that is where what neighborhood they live in and which school by there they choose which school to attend, where their friends may attend. We have had a lot of cuts, closures, consolidations. We went from five comprehensive high schools down to two comprehensive high schools, Union and Ottawa, but then we've opened up specialty schools. So University Prep Academy was one that opened, and you'll see that has a significant percentage of African-American students in it, and the students and their families are drawn to different schools for various reasons, and it can be based on historically that's where mom and dad went, or their older brother and sister, so that's where they're compelled to go. It could be that they have a particular interest in the theme that is at one of the schools like Innovation Central High that has five different academies. And so I think part of it is if you go through and you break out the neighborhoods across the city and where you have concentrations of African American, which is predominantly the southeast side, which is the Ottawa Hills feeder pattern, or southwest side, which is predominantly Latinx students and families, that Union High School, that is part of that feeder pattern. And so there's a lot of there's a lot that drives into this that is historic, that is decades old, but it's also kind of where students and families have chosen to live and where the attendance area boundary is for their school.
John, do you feel that that the Grand Rapids Public Schools has made enough progress to satisfy the OCR?
Well, we have, because they wrote to us last year and said you no longer need to continue with your voluntary compliance. Do I think that we've satisfied the commitment that we made to voluntary? We certainly have made significant strides, and I think that's evidence in the numbers. However, I don't think that we'll ever, I think we have a lot of work to do, and that we should continue to approach this as if we are still under this voluntary agreement with Office of Civil Rights. That's our commitment to serving our students. That's our commitment to equity, inclusion, and ensuring all children have equal access to these opportunities.
Work in progress.
It's absolutely a work in progress. I mean, there is no silver bullet in public education, certainly not in urban education. We are taking a comprehensive approach to how we transform our schools. That's why our transformation plan has been so successful. But you unpack the data, and despite significant increases in grad rates and reductions in chronic absenteeism, the number of kids that are proficient in third grade reading is still at an unacceptably low level. And these are things that we have the best, most highly qualified teachers who are working day in and day out. This is not just a challenge for Grand Rapids Public Schools. Districts across this state and across this nation are facing similar challenges. And this goes to the inequity that exists in how we are funding and supporting our schools. Some of this is historic, where high needs, high poverty districts are historically underfunded and have really been put in some difficult positions. So we talked about all those cuts and closures that under-resourcing has created some of these problems. And there is study after study after study that has proven this. And it's now time that the legislature takes a deep dive at what we need to do to ensure there's more equitable outcomes and opportunities for our students of color, for high needs, high poverty students. The Michigan School Finance Research Collaborative, they have recommendations. The legislature, they had their adequacy study. Former Lieutenant Governor Kelly, he had his special ed study, all of which points to that our highest need, highest poverty, and highest minority students have really been inadequately resourced to meet their individual academic, social, and emotional needs.
John Helmholt is Executive Director of Communications and External Affairs for the Grand Rapids Public Schools. It was good to talk with you, John. Thank you.
It was great talking with you, and thank you for raising the questions and really drawing this out and putting a spotlight on this issue. We appreciate it. We are all about transparency, accountability, and driving in deep on this data so we can improve student outcomes.
Coming up, we'll continue our conversation about inequity in our public schools with an Eastern Michigan University professor who studies desegregation.
Now, the question is, where do we go after we identify the issue? And what's the standard that you use to say much more is needed? And how do you begin to do that?
That's up next on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Grand Rapids Public Schools was part of a voluntary agreement with the Federal Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights to address issues of access to programs for Black students. That agreement ended last year. We continue our look at Grand Rapids Public Schools as we turn to an expert in school desegregation. Ronald Woods is a professor of Africology and African American Studies at Eastern Michigan University. I asked him what stood out to him in my conversation with John Hemhold about Grand Rapids Public Schools' efforts to improve opportunities for Black students.
One of the things was Mr. Hemhold said quite near the end, and that is even without the requirement that the Office of Civil Rights would be continuing this, he said we have to continue to operate as though we are working with the Office of Civil Rights. I think that is perhaps the most important thing, that you realize that it is a constant work in progress and that there is much to be done. Many of the things that he spoke of and that the Grand Rapids circumstance does highlight is what we in few decades back called second and third generation desegregation issues. Now, we've stopped using that terminology because it's sort of hard to determine where we break that generation. But these are some of the offshoots of what our journey over the last 60 to 70 years almost has gotten us.
So put this Grand Rapids Public Schools situation into some context for us, if you would, Professor. How common is it for school districts to voluntarily enter into agreements with federal regulators like the Office of Civil Rights?
Well, it is a common thing in various states. You do have orders of this sort, sometimes being brought by persons who are challenging things that school districts are doing. And I think here in Michigan, we may have some 10 to 11 districts that are under some form of what would be called, say, a voluntary desegregation order, although Grand Rapids would be a slightly different type. So these are not at all uncommon. The reason they're not uncommon is that there is a intricacy about achieving that issue of equal opportunity in education.
It's a heavy lift.
It is a very heavy lift. It takes a great deal of focus, a great deal of common commitment to get to that. And it is something that is embedded in the structures and systems, both of our school systems, but more importantly, within the structure and systems that operate within our social order.
How do we view the voluntary aspect of this? Is this an approach that school districts take to avoid an involuntary agreement that or order that could be more onerous? Or is it an example of a district admitting, you know, it has work to do and being proactive to addressing the problems? Or is it somewhere in between?
A bit of it is somewhere in between. But I think the reality is that once presented with the data, the practices, et cetera, one understands that you will either proceed down this journey toward the possibility of an involuntary agreement flowing from court action, or you will recognize where one is and begin the process. That really is the preferred route where I, school superintendent, under the pressures of a Office of Civil Rights investigation, and the data was pretty compelling, I think there would be much wisdom to proceeding in an involuntary way.
Given your expertise, was OCR correct to flag Grand Rapids Public Schools and ask for changes?
I believe surely so. Now, this investigation began almost a decade or so ago. It is correct in the sense that the driving aspect for what the Office of Civil Rights of the U.S. Department of Education was doing was the Civil Rights Act of 1964, Title VI, which basically says that if one is a recipient of federal dollars, as Grand Rapids and many other school systems would be, that one has an obligation to have a non-discriminatory approach. And what is required and what that flags is actions that are purposeful and intentional as a denial of equal educational opportunity are those which, though facially neutral, do result in disparate outcomes. Clearly, what we see in Grand Rapids, as with so many other districts, is a situation where there are many disparities, many operating inequalities, and that's why you have to get to a situation of this sort. And that was the driving piece that the Office of Civil Rights was working upon.
And how would you rate the federal involvement here? Was the OCR's involvement effective?
It's hard to say that it was effective. I do think that its investigation and its approach was a very detailed and targeted and appropriate way of going about it. One of the major things that one sees in this kind of investigation and in the various reports and letters that were part of the communication and the findings, et cetera, was that it looked in a very specific way at several zones of operation. And it went beyond the issue of just what do the numbers say. That study began to say, why are these numbers saying this? And what can be done? Some of these things may be very intangible, having to do with peer pressure of students not to go into certain programs. Others of these things may be much more targeted, and you've got to come up with a response. So on balance, it was a very focused approach to the problems that we have. Now, the question is, where do we go after we identify the issue? And what's the standard that you use to say much more is needed? And how do you begin to do that?
If you've just joined us, I'm speaking with Ronald Woods, who's a professor of Africology and African American Studies at Eastern Michigan University, as we talk about the resolution agreement between the Federal Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights and Grand Rapids Public Schools after there was a realization there was an underrepresentation of African Americans in college and career prep classes and programs in Grand Rapids. So that agreement lasted 4 years, and the Department of Education said last year the district completed its obligations. We've just heard the district spokesperson cite some pretty significant efforts and some changes they've made because of the agreement. What do you make of those efforts?
I think those efforts are surely appropriate efforts. The question is, how impactful have those efforts been? Because the disparities, even as the Office of Civil Rights noted, in some areas are continuing to manifest themselves. So in part, the issue is, where do you go when the disparities are still there? A good faith effort has been made to address them. Do you say all has now been addressed, or do you keep at it? So that is one of the things that comes out of this. A very good job, in my view, of identifying the operational nuances, and not so nuanced, of the discriminatory patterns. But whether or not it was the appropriate time to say one is fully relieved of the oversight, I think is open to discussion. And there were some points where I might myself say we need to continue to focus on this in a much more strategic way.
What changes might you recommend, given what you know of the district's situation?
Well, I think, for instance, that one of the areas that the report identified was issues of peer pressure that it felt might have kept certain students of color from moving into and aggressively pursuing certain programs. Now, the district is doing good things in that regard. It's got a couple of programs, a Ladies of Distinction program, another one dealing with young men, students in school. So I think one just has to keep the foot on the lever in those areas. There are things that dealt with issues of parental engagement, and issues of parental engagement as a stimulating factor to course selection, career preparation, etc. That is a issue that is common across many school districts, that we need to get a more aggressive involvement and buy-in to a number of these things.
Certainly not just Grand Rapids.
That's right. Yes.
What's the difference in your mind between providing more opportunities, doing outreach to make sure families know about these opportunities, which certainly is what it sounds like Grand Rapids Public Schools has really stepped up to make that happen, and ensuring actual success for all students, which the data from Grand Rapids has yet to convincingly show?
One has to recognize the need for continued engagement on these issues. One also has to be constantly tweak the system. Until we get this thing right, we have to continue working at it. And it is, again, a work in progress.
Considering all of the data, would it be accurate to call Grand Rapids Public Schools segregated?
In some zones, we consider segregation to be something that is formally and by the action of a school district done with the purposeful intent of achieving that outcome. This, again, it may in some instances be a matter of, I don't want to say semantics, but the issues that Grand Rapids is now approaching would have, if we were looking at these same things 30 years ago, simply have been called a second or third generation desegregation issue. The key is that whether we call them a segregated system or one that denies equality of outcome, we're still wrestling with the same entity.
You know, thinking of what we're talking about, how much are these problems specific to Grand Rapids, and how much do they also reflect similar situations facing other urban school districts in Michigan and across the country?
I think they're very consistent with what we see across the country. And the reason that they are consistent, which is not to say that every school system's data will be the same as any other school system's data, but there are some common denominators that are driving this. One is within the educational arena, and this is where Grand Rapids is attempting to make the adjustments and the transformations that it needs to make. But the quest for equal education in America is a quest that is multi-layered. It has many things outside of the operations of the school systems. It has to do with, as Mr. Himmel said, segregated or residential patterns that are segregated. It has to do with income inequality and wealth gaps, disparities in health and health care and access. So there is a commonality that we will see and common denominators that are quite similar across the country.
For those of us who don't live in Grand Rapids or have children going to school in that district, what does all of this show us more broadly about the challenges that educators face in Michigan when it comes to improving the outcomes for low-income and minority students?
It tells us that we need to make some very strategic adjustments in how we approach this question of the quest for equal educational opportunity. I think one of the big challenges in the state of Michigan is the impact of the voucher debate and the impact of the proliferation of charter schools upon the capital, both human capital and financial capital, that we can devote to the quest for public education. Until we can restore a sense of public education as a public trust, we will be at best just staying afloat in the water. We will not be making progress.
Ronald Woods, professor of Africology and African American Studies at Eastern Michigan University. It's been a pleasure to have you with us on Stateside. Thank you so very much.
Well, it's surely my pleasure as well. Thank you.
General Motors CEO Mary Barra is scheduled to meet today with President Trump in the Oval Office. And of course, this meeting comes after the president's criticism of GM, well, for shifting business to China over the last couple decades, also emission rules. And let's talk about this now as we say hi to Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Daniel, do we know who asked for this meeting today?
We don't, and we don't know what's on the agenda. And it's on the president's calendar, and it just says closed press. So we don't know what's going to be said afterwards, if anything, or availability. But I think this comes at a very interesting time. You know, as you noted, the president has criticized General Motors for allegedly taking jobs and plants to China, which is not true, number one. But this, we also have auto talks going on. We've got this controversy over emissions rules and setting of emissions rules. A couple of other automakers have cut a deal with the state of California. GM is not one of those. I presume that that's going to be part of the discussion. And the president has been very embarrassed by the GM's plan to close a plant in Northeast Ohio in Lawrencetown Assembly. That's where he went famously, I think, a year and a half ago and said, don't sell your homes. The manufacturing jobs are coming back. And in fact, I think what he's seeing is they're not necessarily coming back. In fact, manufacturing job growth is slowing.
And of course, we know the UAW has targeted GM for this round of contract talks, and the president has been appealing to UAW members, especially in key Michigan, a state very important to his reelection. Mm-hmm. So what is his interest in these contract talks? Do you think this will be coming up in the meeting today?
I think it probably will, but I think the thing we have to remember is the president is an expert divider. And I think he sees, as you note, the workforce as his people, his base. And he think he sees the leadership as an enemy and somebody to be criticized. And as a lot of your listeners know, there's an ongoing and widening federal corruption investigation into Solidarity House and the joint training centers that are funded by the automakers. And it's now reaching to the highest reaches of the union. President Gary Jones' home in Canton was raided by FBI, IRS, and Department of Labor agents last week, as well as his predecessor Dennis Williams out in California. So I think you're seeing a lot of political dimensions here and legal dimensions that the company and the union bargainers cannot control. You know, what's the Trump effect going to be? What's the Justice Department effect going to be? There's a lot of things going on all at the same time, and I suspect that that's one of the things that Mary Barra knows she's got to manage.
And we've got this trade war with China, and we don't have a new NAFTA.
No, and I don't think you're going to get it. I mean, the Democrats and the control of the House, they have no political incentive and no motivation to give the president a win, certainly going into an election year. So I think, you know, in the trade agenda, the president, he ran on the trade agenda, and he has not delivered, frankly, anything of substance. He's continuing to belly bump with China. He has not been able to deliver, and I don't think probably will be able to deliver NAFTA 2.0. And he's also keeping a lot of our allies in other parts of the world wondering what he's going to do next. This brinksmanship and unpredictability is deadly for business investment decision-making. It's deadly. And that's why you're seeing business investment slowing down around the country and around the world.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Daniel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.